signs eventually grew into 66 Signs of Neon, an exhibition that traveled nationally and internationally for years.
I want to know what's going on, baby. Yes, I want to know what's going on right now, people.
So, next time you're anywhere near Joshua Tree, do visit Noah Purifoy's Desert Art Museum. As writer Ismail Muhammad, a frequent museum visitor, said in his 2021 LA Times article, I have this feeling that what Purifoy was searching for with his assemblages was the social life of junk. Not just inanimate objects, but also all of us cast-off people who were formerly things and must continue to function as things for the world to continue on as it does. There's something to think about. Until next time, this is Kim Weir for Up the Road.
This is KZFR 90.1, Chico listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. Tonight on Ecotopia, we will be discussing climate change and climate-related emotions that the crisis brings about.
A parking lot with a pink hotel, a boutique, and a swinging hot spot. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. They took all the trees, put them in a tree museum. Charge the people a dollar and a half just to see them. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. Ooh, ooh, hey, farmer, farmer, put away the DDT now. Give me spots on my apples, or leave me the birds and the bees. Go, that you don't know what you've got till it's gone. They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. Late last night, I heard the screen door slam, and a big yellow taxi took away my old man. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? The paved paradise, put up a parking lot. I said, don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? The paved paradise, put up a parking lot. The paved paradise, put up a parking lot. The paved paradise, put up a parking lot.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1 FM Chico, exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, technological, looking for solutions to some of Earth's current problems such as global warming, overpopulation, social justice, fossil fuels, and pollution of water, land, and air. My name is Jared Geiser, and I'm in the studio in Chico co-hosting Ecotopia today with Maggie Scarpa while Susan and Stephen Chudy are away traveling. And tonight on Ecotopia, we'll be discussing climate change and the emotions it brings about with Dr. Britt Ray, author of Generation Dread, who is coming to Chico to share some of her insights on the psychological toll of the climate crisis, as well as to help people find purpose amidst the uncertainty that lies ahead. And Ecotopia is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Neil Yelland, a financial advisor with Edward Jones in Chico. No matter where you are in life's journey, Neil can offer guidance and strategies for wealth and retirement income, college savings account, estate and legacy plans, charitable giving, and more. For a consultation or more information, Neil can be reached at 530-345-8913 on the corner of 3rd Ave and the Esplanade. Neil Yelland, Edward Jones member, SIPC. Ecotopia is also made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Dr. Ken Logan, family practitioner. Ken believes in the importance of community radio and encourage other members of the medical community to join the KZFR underwriting family. That's Dr. Ken Logan, family practitioner. And I'll give it a brief disclaimer that the opinions expressed on Ecotopia do not necessarily express the views of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, volunteers, underwriters, and programmers.
Our guest tonight is Dr. Britt Ray, who she is a human and planetary health postdoctoral fellow at the Stanford Center for Innovation and Global Health, Stanford Woods Institute for the Environment, and the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. Her research focuses on the mental health impacts of the ecological crisis. Dr. Britt is the creator of a weekly newsletter about staying sane in the climate crisis, Gen Dread, and author of Generation Dread, Finding Purpose in the Age of the Climate Crisis. Dr. Britt has her PhD in science communications from the University of Copenhagen, and Generation Dread is her second book. Her first book is Rise of Necrofauna, The Science, Ethics, and Risks of De-Extinction. She's hosted several podcasts, radio, and TV programs with BBC, CBC, and is a TED speaker. Welcome to the show, Dr. Britt Ray.
Having some technical difficulties. One moment so we can get Britt on the line. Bear with us, folks. We'll get the Britt Ray interview on in just a moment.
It opens in Zara automatically.
All right, we'll try this again. Welcome to the show, Dr. Britt Ray.
Hi. Nice to be with you. Thanks.
Anthropogenic climate change is happening and the world is on track for a climate catastrophe. On the brink of a huge species extinction, extreme heat waves, huge flooding events, sea level rise, mega droughts, and more. This information and the fact that little has been done to mitigate the climate crisis can enact an emotional and psychological toll. Could you explain and describe climate anxiety and other climate-related emotions a bit more?
Sure. So there's an emerging terminology for the emotional reactions people are having to a changing planet. Climate anxiety, as you mentioned, is a popular household term now. It relates to eco-anxiety, another really big popular one, which is defined by the American Psychological Association as the chronic fear of environmental doom. Climate anxiety, of course, is just a climate-specific form of it, but we've got all kinds of other non-climate-related, well, they're all climate-related, but non-climate-specific environmental issues that can bring about that, whether we're talking biodiversity, land transformation, water scarcity, food scarcity issues, all of that being belonging to eco-anxiety. But there's also ecological grief, this sense of loss that comes with owning up to the losses already underway in terms of degraded ecosystems, species going extinct, also cultural traditions that are disappearing with certain landscapes when people can't carry out certain traditional roles or occupational roles, farmers reporting, feeling a lot of grief about not being able to recommend or literally pass on because it's not materially possible anymore, their farming practices to the next generation as they deteriorate with drought conditions, let's say, or Inuit communities in Canada who are people of the ice reporting immense grief when the core of their identity, the ice, is melting and they can't carry out traditional hunting and fishing and trapping and ancestral kinds of activities that have been going on in their community for thousands of years. That brings a profound emotional rupture within an individual and often a community. But it's also future losses that we're contending with. It's not just what's already underway. It's this anticipatory grief for what might be lost as the climate crisis intensifies that people are also going through. So these are some of the terms that help us get a grip on what these emotional realities are for people. But many people in the climate psychology field will say what we're actually talking about is an umbrella of challenging emotions. Climate anxiety isn't just anxiety. It co-occurs with fear, sadness, anger, rage, sense of helplessness, powerlessness, dread, all kinds of things that are uncomfortable but have important information for us to listen to about what's under threat, how we ought to respond, and the turbulence, while it can be very overwhelming, it can cause a person to really lose a lot of well-being points and damage mental health and trap someone in a pit of despair or hopelessness, which demands support for how to integrate and process those emotions in caring community. But we also know there's an existing evidence base that's growing to show that climate anxiety can also be really constructive, a form of practical anxiety that causes someone to make meaningful changes and come together with others to push for climate action. So it's a delicate construct to parse out because it does these bad things to us as well as these good things for us. The most vulnerable communities are young people writ large. As a generation, I'm talking like millennials and Gen Z, especially compared to older generations, whether we're talking Gen X and boomers and beyond, are feeling this distress more poignantly in their lives. We have a survey that my colleagues and I were involved in last year of 10,000 16 to 25 year olds in 10 countries around the world, in places like India, Nigeria, Philippines, Pakistan. Nope, that's not true. India, Nigeria, Philippines, UK, US, France, Finland, Brazil, Portugal. 45% of those global respondents said that their feelings about the climate crisis are negatively impacting their daily functioning. That's very impairing. That's a huge number. And then when you go to some of the most climate vulnerable countries, those experiencing most disasters and have lower incomes nationally to deal with adaptation, like India, Nigeria, Philippines, that functional impairment goes up to 74%, which is huge. And, you know, really negative thoughts, like feeling 75% saying that the future is frightening, 56% of young people around the world saying that humanity is doomed, and 39% saying that the climate crisis makes them hesitant to have their own children one day. So you can see that kind of really challenging emotional landscape in which many young people are existing in relation to the climate emergency, which demands support and taking this seriously and validating it. But they're not the only ones who jump out as being a frontline community on the emotional landscape. We've also got, unsurprisingly, those who are living in climate disaster zones, experiencing hazards or experiencing environmental injustice, living next to polluting sites, dealing with the kinds of systemic oppressions from a structural level that make often low income and communities of color fight for climate justice because it's affecting their communities in these ways that deteriorate health now and already. And when you look at distress about the climate crisis in those communities, it's also higher than in more privileged communities or white communities. If we're looking in the United States, for instance, we have other data to show that climate professionals as well are susceptible to this kind of emotional, psychological toll of bearing witness to the climate crisis. So scientists, mitigation and adaptation professionals, environmental journalists, writers, that sort of thing, people who are professionally bearing witness. And so that just means that their thoughts are on this. And we know that our thoughts can affect our feelings. And of course, if we're taking in lots of information in our cognitive structures that are scary and alarming, well, of course, it's going to affect our emotional tenor, right? So those are some of the key communities who we can talk about when it comes to climate anxiety.
I know your PhD is a little bit different to the work you're working on now. What drew you to working in this like nexus between psychology and the climate crisis? And is this space new?
Yeah, so my PhD is in science communication with a focus on synthetic biology. And as I was wrapping that up, I became overcome with my own distress about the climate crisis. It really, while being something that I cared about for years and had a background in conservation biology, I mean, bearing witness to the sixth mass extinction of the more than human world is what you are tasked with when you're in that field. So none of it was new information, but it became really, the emotions took on a different shape and spikiness when my partner and I started talking about trying to get pregnant. And instead of being able to just embrace that decision as I thought or assumed that I would be doing because I wanted to have a kid, it instead was this giant dilemma around whether or not I could do that and feel okay with that decision, knowing what that will be subjecting a new person to in terms of climate trends, what the science tells us because of the cost of historical inaction and the kind of losses that are baked in, let alone how much worse these could get if we don't get our act together. So then it just became really turbulent. It was impairing my functioning, you know, it was a really big thing in my life or clouding my worldview. And I thought, geez, I'm a science communicator. Maybe I can turn this lens of trying to get to the bottom of stories about science and society where they collide in my own life. Like the climate crisis is living inside me in a new way. And I didn't know if I was alone in those fears and thoughts. It was a handful of years ago. No one was really talking about this publicly. I found one group of activists called Conceivable Future who were connecting reproductive justice to the climate crisis and organizing house parties around the US where people could voice these concerns. And that was validating, but otherwise it was quiet. And yet it's been head spinning to see how in the years since we've got tons of statistics, surveys, national polls, New York Times, you know, issued polls, even Miley Cyrus, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, like famous figures coming out and validating this concern for the millennial and younger generations. And we've got, just many people aware of it. So it's not surprising when it comes up and families having conversations, grandparents being told they're not going to be grandparents because, you know, the climate crisis has ended up in the intimate parts of their kids' lives. And so because I had that distress, I just and I wanted to get to a more constructive way of relating to my feelings, I started doing research for first a radio documentary and then a book, which eventually turned into Generation Dread, which was recently published, but has been something I've been working on for those years in between. And while my on-ramp to the subject was my own distress about the baby dilemma, it really very quickly widened out into a broader inquiry about the emotional psychological impacts of the climate crisis, which can shape our mental health and well-being. Yes, looking at what they are so we can describe them, but also importantly, how we can respond to them, what the mental health field needs to do to be able to support people in an unprecedented time of increasing turbulence and the kind of scope of psychic damage or trauma that comes with that, given climate disasters, yes, but then also the fact that people's mere awareness of the climate crisis can produce all of this chronic stress that we're seeing, especially in young people. So that's how it was just personal personal need for my own coping tools, and realizing that whatever I found that could be resonant for me would maybe be able to help other people. And in the years since, the field has exploded. It's just this huge topic that the world is ready to talk about. If I had published this book back then in 2017, I would have been chastised. I don't think anyone would have really wanted to talk to me about it. I would have been written off as being overly dramatic and rooted in catastrophic thinking. But the zeitgeist in our cultural narratives have changed so much, and there's been really a verve of heart-centered, gut-centered kind of existential writing out in the popular imagination, you know, The Uninhabitable Earth, those kinds of books, bringing people up to speed on what this could mean in really human terms for us, which of course has an emotional toll. And then it's creeping into our institutions. More researchers are looking at this. We've got the data now to show the phenomenon at a global level and in local communities. And basically the writing's on the wall for leaders in our institutions and understanding that this is a serious issue. So it's not new. People have been combining psychology and environmental thinking back since the 70s, eco-psychology. And this kind of comes out of that, or parts of this inquiry today comes out of that tradition. Eco-anxiety as a term, it can be traced back to some newspaper article from the mid-90s about folks in Chesapeake Bay who were worried about local pollution. But Glenn Albrecht, an environmental philosopher, I believe started using the term in like 2007 or 2011, something in and around there. And then it's only taken off with the way that we currently refer to it in the last, you know, especially since Greta Thunberg and students have mobilized around the world. It's taken on new meaning as a result of how people are voicing their distress and pain and anger.
Certainly, yeah. Yeah, well, thank you so much for this, like, really cutting-edge work in this new field that's just exploding. Really grateful for your new book, Generation Dread. And so in chapter two of this book, the chapter two is called The Power of Denial. So in this chapter, you discuss different reasons why people maintain false beliefs relating to climate change denial. You describe denial as a human psychological adaptation for survival. Would you please elaborate on this and discuss the different forms of denial that you talk about in your book?
Yeah, so we have all evolved to have these impressive psychological defenses that can allow us to pretend ourselves away from reality when reality is tough to bear. So things that push away what is uncomfortable or allow us to stick our heads in the sand or create some distance. And generally, people are pretty bad at feeling uncomfortable, sitting in uncomfortable feelings. There's a very low tolerance for that, unless and until people intentionally and consciously work on their skills and work on how their nervous system behaves in the face of uncertainty or threat, you know, scary thoughts, things like this. And so in the climate space, we think of climate denial typically as this kind of really thought through, planned, strategic, well-funded campaign of public misinformation and disinformation that we've been subject to at the hands of fossil fuel executives and the PR firms that they can endow with millions of dollars to pump the public square full of fake experts and cherry-picked data and all kinds of rhetorical slams to try and discredit the importance of the greenhouse effect and so on and so forth. Greenwashing today, you know, their tactics have changed, but the result is the same: to delay the transition to a green economy and energy system.
Mm-hmm.
And denial is actually way more subtle than that. That's outright denial, but we all also unwittingly participate in denial because we have these forms of soft denial within us. Like the one that when I first learned about it hit home for me was disavowal. So psychoanalysts, they're the ones who really understand the human unconscious and study it and speak to it and know how to work with it out of, you know, the professions that we have out there. And so the psychoanalysts focused on climate helped me understand this concept of disavowal, which is essentially when you have one eye open to the truth and one eye closed at the same time as a self-protective measure to ensure that you are not submitted to too much distressing information at all times so that you can keep functioning and preserve your sanity, essentially. So with one eye, you know, you believe that this is all so incredibly urgent. You read about us potentially surpassing dangerous climate tipping points, which will unleash cascading change that is irreversible. You know, you want to support all forms of climate action. So it's not about denial, right? It's about culturally supporting the shift that we need to make. But then simultaneously, you kind of close your eyes to that truth. And you, in yourself, don't believe that such terrible things can ever really come to pass. And turn away from the implications of this for migration crises and stoking conflict and like famine and drought and all these things. And put your attention elsewhere so that you can feel okay. And then you want a vacation. So you jump on the next plane and you order your stuff from Amazon because it's more convenient. And you actually don't go out and vote for that representative who you meant to, who had that good climate policy and so on and so forth. And this is kind of a state in which many of us are living. It's caring, but also being caught up in our ways of operating that are serving our immediate needs and preventing us from making some massive and uncomfortable shifts that we are required to. So that's a type of soft denial that keeps us thwarted. And the thing is that it happens unconsciously. We're not like thinking, oh, now I'm going to close one eye and keep, you know what I mean? And do this thing where I turn away. No, it's like, it's all just happening and we're not conscious of it. And this is also why a lot of people feel helpless in this crisis, because they see that they're not easily tapping into lots of meaningful change, but these are the kinds of defenses that promote that. And so, yeah, I mean, they're in us for a reason, these defenses. They've helped us deal with life-threatening scenarios and difficult situations, restoring our ability to feel grounded enough or calm enough or resilient enough to keep pushing and keep going, mm-hmm. because it can be really taxing to focus on all the stuff that feels intolerable. But we need to get a better handle and more emotionally intelligent approach to the way that our unconscious is also alive in this anthropogenic problem, right? It's anthropogenic. That means it's human caused. If it's human caused, it relates to our behavior. Our behavior is heavily influenced not only by our rational decision making. I mean, we like to think that we're rational creatures. Actually, no, we're hugely irrational and driven by emotion and driven by unconscious elements that we don't, most of us, think about, understand, or notice. So it's about bringing all of that into the picture of what it means to think about change.
On a similar note about how we think about this climate crisis and whatnot and how our own actions relate to it, let's talk about individual carbon footprints. So in the book Generation Dread, you write about manipulative actions taken by the true perpetuators of climate change to diffuse responsibility for the crisis, such as in 2005, British Petroleum ran a really expensive media campaign, over $100 million, on this campaign that promoted the idea of a personal carbon footprint that individual humans are responsible for. So if you would, please explain how this individual carbon footprint warps people's perception about who is responsible for climate change and where the changes need to be made to address the issue.
Yeah, so there had been a concept of an ecological footprint coming out of good faith academic settings earlier than that. And then this carbon footprint concept, of course, is very sensible to us, right? We think, oh, how can I make change? I can try and lower my carbon footprint in the ways in which my activities are harming the ecosphere that's most valuably tapped into by the way I heat my home and get around and so on and so forth. But when taken up by the PR marketing machinery of one of the world's most powerful corporations in the most powerful industry sector, who profit off of increased emissions, and they are then wielding it to throw back onto the consumer, hey, what are you doing? It's a massive distraction when asking the public to focus on their carbon footprint. Speaking to this gaping hole of guilt that so many of us are walking around with, because we know, especially if we're living in an industrialized nation with high carbon intensivity, that we are contributing to this problem, which makes us feel unsafe, which is crazy making in itself. And there's not, it's much easier for people to go there in thinking about change and ways for them to intervene than having a more critical, structural, and comprehensive understanding of the history of corporate malfeasance in this space to distract and delay from real science and real actions that need to be taken, as it has pumped the culture with this, as Naomi Oreskes would say, the sowing of doubt, just the way that the tobacco industry did, the sowing of doubt about tobacco's harmful health effects for years, kind of tricking the public into accepting its products until at a certain point that was called out and investigated, which we're now at with the climate crisis and these fossil fuel executives and their lobbyists and, you know, the bot politicians and the marketing that has gone along with this. This is increasingly clear thanks to lots of great science historians and investigative journalists. But what this BP marketing campaign is just another cog in the wheel, another tactic that they have the resources to be able to take the attention off of them when we might otherwise be able to hold their feet to the fire and see tons of the emissions, like an enormous proportion of the emissions that we need to lower are produced by the drilling, extraction, refining of oil and gas products themselves. Right. So when the proportion is dwarfing that of what individuals are putting out there, it's really a bad faith argument. And it's a rhetorical tool to essentially continue to seed this world of make believe in which we're going to solve this through individuals who feel especially guilty, like scrutinizing themselves about ways they can make their own carbon footprint disappear, rather than going to the more effective levers that we can push on, which is, you know, really taxing the fossil fuel industry for their pollution and starting to ramp it down.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR Chico. If you've just tuned in, we're interviewing Dr. Britt Ray, author of Generation Dread. Dr. Britt Ray is coming to Chico State October 13th to give a lecture on finding purpose in the age of climate crisis, with a reception and a book signing to follow.
In your book, you also cite statistics on how many people don't want or don't wish to have kids because of their concerns with the climate crisis, and how people are concerned with their carbon emissions of procreation. You also write your own thought process that you've discussed about the thought process with your partner. Could you explain to our listeners about your analysis on the issue of bringing children into the world in the midst of this climate crisis? And if you can, tie in how many people may adopt eco-fascist or anti-humanist beliefs on this topic.
The biggest question in the world.
We can only break it up and like maybe.
No, it's good. It's good. It's good. It's great. It's great. It's given me a lot to think about. So, yes, there are a variety of reasons that people who are expressing concern over having kids biologically in the climate crisis that they put forth as to why that is. For some, it's concern about what more human footprints will do to an already overburdened planet, ecologically speaking. And so there is that carbon footprint kind of equation or logic going, I can make a contribution to lowering my carbon footprint by not actually having kids who will then consume things that are taxing to our carbon budget. However, what I have found in my research is a far more prevalent concern these days with people in diverse settings around the world is not that, but the concern about what a warming world does to threaten the safety and security and well-being and health of any child born today. And so it's a dilemma or concern rooted in fear, rooted in compassion for the child, rooted in a protective parenting instinct, and worry that there would come a point when they can't protect their child no matter what. So there's also, on the flip side, some political reasons that people can cite for deciding to not have kids out of climate concerns, such as that a kid takes a heck of a ton of energy, time, resources, and leaves you with very little expendable free time to do activism, to take up whatever role in society you want to on this crisis. Many activists have cited that it's just too much, it's too demanding to both fight the climate crisis and have a kid and raise a family at the same time. And or, you know, perhaps they're into civil disobedience and it is not possible for them to go get arrested when they're breastfeeding. These kinds of things have come up. So you can see there's like a wide variety of concerns that climate aware folks who are wrestling with this might cite. And it's different for different communities. My colleague, Jade Sasser, who is a professor of gender studies at University of California, Riverside, has been doing research with youth of color in the U.S. around their existential emotions and what that means for the reproductive choices. And while climate anxiety is on the list for many of these young youth of color, it comes alongside other immediate threats to their well-being, like racial capitalism, you know, racial violence, political strife, economic insecurity, concerns about how to provide for a child. And then you throw the climate crisis on top, and the idea that they would have to contend with all of those at the same time as the structural barriers they're already experiencing in their communities is just too much. Like, how do you do all that and afford to have a child and protect them? So, you know, these are some of the nuances that are important to get at. And in terms of what comes up often in this conversation are kind of knee-jerk reactions, say, well, adoption is the solution. You know, if you don't want to have these moral kind of quandaries hanging over your head, then adopt, because there's people who need loving families who are already here, and this could solve all of the complexity you're wrestling with. And then, you know, some people who have adopted out of environmental concerns will pipe up and say, yes, it's not that easy. It's not, you know, for the faint-hearted either. It isn't just a quick fix solution, like a plug and play, make your family in the climate crisis, get it off the shelf with this direction. You know, it's its own world, which requires more thought and attention. And so I've noticed that dynamic a lot come up in terms of the difficulties that are involved in adoption too, and still the vulnerability of kids in the climate crisis and what it means to be a caretaker for them. And then, you know, there's a lot of important leadership that's come from the queer community for ages and queer scholarship about how family ought to look like, you know, beyond this kind of narrow heteronormative nuclear family conception that the dominant culture puts up as the valid family, especially in times when we need communities of care and we need to live well in, you know, in the midst of strained resources and things like this. What are multi-generational households who have multiple parents taking care of fewer children, and parents might not be each other's lovers, chosen family, and these other constellations that allow one to broaden the scene and stage of what a family is and how lifelong relationships are cultivated in climate aware ways that have also weighed in on the conversation really importantly. So yeah, I think it's a really interesting social phenomenon to see how today's people of childbearing age are responding to this. We have pretty good data to show that roughly in a lot of kind of Western industrialized nations, there's about a third, roughly, and I'm now extrapolating across different studies, but it's often around a third of people who say that they're either not having kids or considering not having kids or having fewer than they would otherwise want to because of the climate crisis. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, what that means for future decision making and family models, it's going to be interesting to watch. And you mentioned bringing ecofascism into that. So, I mean, to draw one connection, there are a lot of still like dogs clamping down on a bone, arguments out there saying the real issue is overpopulation. Mm-hmm. Like, let's just cut to the chase. There's too many of us and that's what pollutes the planet. And there's a really long history of that kind of what would be referred to as neo-Malthusian thinking from the ideas of Malthus way back hundreds of years ago through to Paul Ehrlich and ideas in the best-selling Population Bomb book in the 1960s about how the human population has exploded like a nuclear bomb and it's going to kill us all, leading to leading to famines and things like this, mm-hmm. which didn't happen. But really, the folks who are still increasing their numbers in terms of their fertility rate in the world today tend to be the poorest folks among mm-hmm. us, often in places like sub-Saharan Africa, who really consume the least and have the lowest carbon footprints attached to their lifestyles. And yet you look at a country like the United States that has nearly 5% of the world's population and yet has put a quarter of the emissions out historically. So it just doesn't line up, right? In terms of looking at population as the only driver, but the focus on that can lead to this kind of eugenicist thinking, which can be eco-fascist mm-hmm. as well, in terms of who are the kinds of people who ought to be reproducing today. Mm-hmm. If it's not about those privileged people who are sometimes purporting that as the solution, looking back on their own communities and saying, hey, it's actually us who are consuming the most, who ought to reproduce less. It can come down to thinking about, you know, who are the right kinds of people to use the resources that are left in an increasingly strained world. And there's a lot of frenzy and anxiety and tension on the right about immigrants, about refugees, about people from away coming here, so to speak, in search of a better life, that has obviously become very eco-fascist, dangerous, violent, xenophobic, and rooted in othering, which is hugely violating of people's human rights mm-hmm. that we already contend with, and what that means for the climate crisis moving forth, when we're told to expect upwards of 140 million to over a billion climate migrants to be on the move mm-hmm. by 2050, which is not very long away. How on earth? I mean, the mind can't comprehend. We have not seen anything like that before. Mm-hmm. So what's that going to mean with this kind of political reality we're in, where there is a lot of anti-immigrant rhetoric and policy in a variety of countries? Well, when matched also with this reproduction conversation, mm-hmm. it's really complicated, because there's also a lot of concern about places like the US flatlining in their birth rate mm-hmm. and the way to maintain a healthy, stable population, or one that can have enough people creating wealth, you know, or products and services that get taxed to then feed systems of care that are needed, like for elder care, for example, and to go mm-hmm. into infrastructure, into healthcare and education and all that, then you need to rely on immigration. Mm-hmm. And so there's some opportunities to embrace climate, the wave of climate migration that's coming in these helpful, fruitful ways, but not if it's rooted in, you know, the fear and the ideology that we know is very rife and resistant of these things from happening. So I will wrap it there, because this is getting long-winded, but
yeah, great. Thank you so much. Yeah, I know, a lot to say, a lot of really great points you brought up. I really appreciate you doing that. Yeah, you talked a little bit about fear and how it can have some negative consequences. And, you know, as we look at the data on climate change, a lot of us are fearful. We have a lot of things to be afraid about. But we also have a lot of things to be hopeful for. And so in chapter 7 of your book, is called Balancing Hope and Fear. And in this chapter, you describe some examples where hope can have negative consequences, as well as some examples of where hope is a positive force, which can enable survival of grueling conditions. So could you please go into detail of your thoughts of hope and the importance of balancing hope with fear?
So there is something really constructive that can come from the alarm of knowing that we're in an emergency like a wartime measure, right? When the enemy is coming, you have to mobilize and get the troops together to protect your butts. It's just not going to work otherwise if you don't feel that existential alarm and people won't step up to make these uncomfortable changes and reorient society and drop everything and go to the task. So in an emergency like the climate emergency, the mobilization response is appropriate because we need to change everything, largely speaking, generally speaking. So that's key. We can't pretend that it is that we're in a situation that doesn't bring about valid forms of fear, anxiety, alarm, panic, you know, things that can be part and parcel. But we can't only focus on that because it will run us dry. We will tap out, burn out. It makes us less effective external action takers, mobilizers. But it also just robs us of our experience of being human at this time when there's so many awe-inspiring, beautiful things about being alive and waking up to this absurd, gorgeous planet every day. And we have to be able to protect our ability to thrive and flourish in those ways that are not just focused on the alarm, right? So balancing. How do we balance and stay effective? Well, I think that the fear that I've really connected with, that was well and succinctly articulated in a way that resonated for me comes from Robert J. Lifton, who's a psychiatrist who studied the atrocities of the 20th century. And he wrote about this concept of the prospective survivor. So while a real survivor is someone who has touched death but made it out alive, right? They've escaped from something that otherwise would have done them in. A prospective survivor is someone who can almost taste how they could die and how mortality would come meet them as a result of imagining these threats becoming actualized. You know, in the climate crisis, it's like really going there, really feeling the alarm, really allowing yourself to absorb the implications, really leaning into the information that your nightmares have to tell you about what we're up against. Not suppressing it and again turning away and pretending it's not there. And from that, you can garner the strength to be able to actually move into the life-saving protections that are now required. So there's a transformative move towards courage, purpose, meaning, bravery, things that are needed in a wartime effort. I mean, if we were to go over and talk to folks in Ukraine right now, we'd find a lot of people filled with this kind of strength and resilience. Mm-hmm. And we're in that weird space right now where if we're not facing down the disaster that is life-threatening right now in this moment, we might not be all that energized by the climate crisis and continue pushing it away. But we see again and again this constructive element of the anxiety and the fear coming from really allowing it to be there and move through you and teach you things. So that starts to create the outcomes of being a prospective survivor so that you boldly like face this with others who are doing the same. And then you link arms with people who would essentially rather die trying than in a state of surrender. Mm-hmm. And when you get to that place, you really muster the life force that is needed to make this change because it is a daunting task that we face and we need to be strong. Mm-hmm. So it's hopeful. It's hopeful to go into the fear and then create that kind of radical action-based hope, which is the thing that helps us, you know, mm-hmm. and moves us towards fostering the better futures than what otherwise come. And we're so resolved about this crisis. You don't get there by feeling comfortable, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think that those are key, but then furthermore, understanding that this is not just about what we want to avoid, it's about what we want to build. It's about what we're moving towards. It's about the better ways existence can and will feel when we're not continuously poisoning ourselves by the way that we get energy and threatening our health across multiple axes. And what doing community care can look like in the places where we live. And getting to the root of the issue. I mean, there are so many more people today talking about the connections between colonialism and extractivism, the modern dominant paradigms that we live in being shaped by those things, and how that gave rise to the climate crisis and also dictates who is most vulnerable to its harms today. By being able to make all of that really clear, we can start addressing the need for worldview change, right? Like massive relational change of how we are being with one another. Mm-hmm. Yeah. As well as relating to these larger systems that govern our economy and life systems across, you know, education, healthcare, neighborhoods, functioning, everything. So, you know, that's also hopeful. It's like we're starting to do that detective work of an archaeological work that, of course, some communities have been doing and knowing this whole time, but it's becoming more and more activated. And so what does that open up in terms of worldview shifts and moving from domination to partnership, as I write about in the book, which is a big topic, but just generally, you know, these things are really hopeful and happening at local scales and trickling up. And so focusing on the positive pro-social tipping points we can be a part of and mustering the kind of courage and resolve from being prospective survivors and knowing that this is not just about a deficit model of what we're losing and trying to avoid more loss, but it's also about thinking creatively about, okay, how can I increase our capacity, my capacity and others to flourish and thrive? Like, how can we bring more meaning and purpose into our life, more appreciation of beauty, more connection and love, more engagement and flow states with things that fill us up, that matter, that bring us joy? All of that also belongs, you know? So
yeah. Great. Thank you so much for it. That was incredible. It touched on a lot of important topics. The worldview one was really profound for me about the importance of shifting our worldview, you know, from this domineering human-centered one to building partnerships, you know, I think to actually bring about like a regenerative society that can live amidst the changing climate. And so we are kind of running out of time. I would like to make another announcement for the event happening at Chico State on October 13th, Thursday, October 13th. Dr. Britt Ray is coming to Chico and she'll be speaking about these topics and about finding purpose in an age of climate crisis. And there'll be a reception and book signing to follow. Before we wrap it up, what do you think can be done to protect and improve people's mental health in a warming world? I know you've touched on different ways of talking about these things, but would you be able to talk about the climate cafes for a minute and how people are engaging in that?
Sure. So climate cafes are these informal gatherings that happen all over the world where people can just host their own. They have a decentralized model. But essentially, it's a frank, open-hearted space where people can come and talk on that emotional level about how they're doing, how they're feeling, and know that it's going to be contained in a permission-giving space with others who get it and can hold up a mirror to those concerns rather than run the risk of being told that they're being overly dramatic or, you know, they should just cheer up or the kinds of responses that you might get when you're just talking to your friends and family if you're especially triggering their defenses and they want to shut you down. So it's a place to process what this means on an individual level, on a human heart level. And for so many people, it's incredibly simple what I just said and what they do. Mm-hmm. But a lot of us sit alone in the feelings and are alienated and isolated with this sense that it's only us who cares this much. Or, you know, feeling like we're just exploring people's apathy every time that we leave the house, just being awash in a sea of humans who aren't talking about this, don't care, just going on with the status quo, making it worse, you know, and all of that is really psychologically damaging. It makes it a much more difficult thing to live with when in fact, many of us are alarmed. Way more of us have feelings about this than we are ever voicing. And so to finally get the outlet to pierce the damaging bubble of silence around these existential emotions is just massively relieving for a lot of people. And the point of the climate cafe is to get a place where it's guaranteed that you can do that and find that connection. And you're going to go home feeling better, especially if you've not talked about these things before, because this is a kind of disenfranchised grief or the grief that is not recognized. Typically, we don't have social norms around how to process it. So it's an invitation to create some social norms to support each other through it and basically just to validate it.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely. Well, thank you, Dr. Britt Ray, for coming on to speak about your new book, Generation Dread, as well as the upcoming event happening at Chico State's campus on Thursday, October 13th.
Well, yeah, thank you so much.
Great. It's great to have you on Ecotopia. And to all of our listeners, be sure to check out and sign up for Dr. Britt Ray's newsletter, Generation Dread. And you can check out the newsletter and get connected to all of her other works, her presentations and books and other writings at Britt, B-R-I-T-T, Ray, W-R-A-Y, .com, .com. And her website has all kinds of great information about this topic and related works. So thanks again, Britt, for being on the show tonight. It was a great interview. Really appreciate your time.
Pleasure's all mine. Thank you.
All right, that wraps up our interview with Dr. Britt Ray. Stay tuned after Ecotopia for North State Give and Take with Bobby Tryon. In the interview with Britt Ray, she talked about climate cafes, and I just wanted to give a plug for the local climate cafes that are going on. Kim Michael Green is facilitating climate cafes at the South Chico Community Assistance Center on 18th and Park the first Tuesday of each month at 6 p.m. For the rest of the year. And these climate cafes will continue next year as well, but they will most likely be on a different schedule. And don't forget to mark your calendars for Dr. Britt Ray's event here at Chico State on October 13th. You've been listening to Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1 FM, Chico, exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, and technological. Thanks for tuning in, and thanks for being a part of the solution to the climate crisis. There is a role for all of us to play in building a more sustainable world. Be sure to visit our website for notes and recordings of recent programs, plus an ever-growing list of resources provided by the guests. The web address is ecotopiakzfr.com. We also welcome your comments and suggestions. Send Susan and Steven an email at ecotopiakzfr@gmail.com. And we're going to close the show tonight with a song by Shutescott Martinez, a young indigenous climate activist and artist. His song, Magic, details the reality of our world, as well as highlights people's resilience amidst the sometimes scary reality.
With each breath I draw, no longer taste it in the water or hear it in the wind. It's fading like the music as the record stops spinning. It's no longer in your eyes, hoping it's only in disguise. Replaced by hunger for everything I despise. Tipping the scales, we lose the balance, we moving mountains. Drilling the shale, we chew the profit, we soak the canvas. Taste the poison whenever the wind blows. Wage war, people suffering while we kill the planet. I lost my innocence sooner than most. I watching our world die, something I couldn't control. And I couldn't have known that I'd never turn back. Now what I care is something that no one could understand. My generations losing sight of the magic I feel. Plagued by insecurity, slippers, bottles of pills. Forgot the beauty of life. You said you were the die, the knees every time you fell. As a step towards the sky. So I took all of my tears, took all of my pain, turned it into poetry and lyrics. They gave me my name with every battle I fight. And every song that I write, every time my ego collides with the passion inside. And every star on this canvas, every word, every line is a hope to restore a magic I can no longer find.
Magic and song in the sound of a drum from the sea to the sky to the land. There's a sun on my skin, I'm at home with the wind elements in the palm of my hand. Magic and song in the sound of a drum from the sea to the sky to the land. There's a sun on my skin, I'm at home with the wind elements in the palm of my hand.
It's all in the trees, all in the wind. Reaching the seas, washing my sins away. Change within, I feel I know myself. And now these days are strange and nights are cold. And people afraid to move forward. Deliver the truth in your word when you grab the moment. Grab the mic. They all go.
North State Give and Take is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by the Cotton Party.
offering contemporary women's clothing and accessories with an emphasis on natural fibers. Right in the heart of downtown Chico, Cotton Party has been providing friendly service for over 30 years at 337 Broadway Street. Cotton Party is grateful for your business and offers complimentary gift wrapping with each purchase. More information by calling Cotton Party at 530-893-4900.